Case number 19-1124 et al. American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers Petitioner versus Environmental Protection Agency.
Good morning, counsel. You may proceed.
Good morning, your honors. May it please the court, Kevin King for the Industry Petitioner Group. I'll be addressing the 10% issue. Your honors, the rule should be vacated because it relies on an unreasonable interpretation of the statute's volatility allowance for fuels containing gasoline and 10% ethanol. The rule interprets that clause as encompassing any blend with at least 10% ethanol, all the way up to 99.9% ethanol. EPA reads in the phrase at least, even though it's not in the statute. And that omission is important here, your honors, because many other parts of the act, including parts enacted at the same time as paragraph H4, contain at least modifiers or similar language. The presence of that language elsewhere in the statute, coupled with its absence in paragraph H4, indicates that it's unreasonable to read in the at least modifier that the rule relies upon. Now, EPA stresses that the statute does not say containing no more than 10% ethanol, and therefore it shouldn't be read as setting a ceiling. And that's true as far as it goes. But what EPA ignores is that the statute also does not say containing at least 10% ethanol. EPA tries to have it both ways by emphasizing the absence of one phrase while ignoring the absence of another. Your honors, we submit that the statute is properly understood as setting a specific requirement, not a floor and not a ceiling. And what that means is that the statute covers blends of gasoline and 10% ethanol with a reasonable tolerance around 10% to account for real-world circumstances like imprecisions in the blending process. That interpretation makes sense given the statute's reference to a percentage, a mathematically precise expression of proportion per 100 units.
And we know that because
We know that because that's the nature of a percentage, right? A percentage expresses how many things are in something per 100 units. That's just the nature of a percentage. But it also, Judge Rogers, links up with the ordinary usage of the word containing when used without a modifier. If I wanted to say, express a floor, what I would say is containing at least 10% or containing 10% or more. But when you use that word without a modifier, as Congress did here, it means a specific amount. And I'll give you just one example. EPA says at page 105 that its brief contains 27,478 words. We all know that means a specific amount. Yet under the rules interpretation, EPA could just as well have said that the brief contains 10 words. And that really demonstrates the unreasonableness of the rules approach in this case.
But if we knew that the briefing rules were wanting to encourage fulsome discussion, so the context matters, right? And so if we wanted people to not skimp on what they wrote and we said, certify how many words your brief contains, we would understand that perhaps to say at least. And I mean, EPA, you say EPA only emphasizes one and not the other missing modifier, but both were considered in the legislative process and both were dropped. So why shouldn't we just look at that as a delegation to EPA consistent with other limitations in the statute to make the kind of determination that it made here?
Yeah, Your Honor, I think the reason is that, just as you say, Congress considered proposals that had the at least modifier. Congress considered proposals that had the at most modifier. It disregarded both of those. It chose instead to adopt a specific requirement, gasoline and containing gasoline and 10% ethanol.
Well, so, that's your reading, that the shearing away of those two confines it to the number. But, you know, it doesn't say exactly or, you know, precisely. So the question is, doesn't that leave it somewhat open? And what's your best argument? I hear you on this precise number that carries some weight. Anything else that we should consider in reading it that way?
Yes, absolutely right. So we agree, Your Honor, that context matters. And there are three contextual clues here that narrow it down from sort of anything EPA wants to a smaller subset, right? The first is the contextual indicator that I mentioned earlier. the same statute, the 1990 Clear Act, Clean Air Act amendments, in which paragraph H4 was adopted, contains numerous other provisions, and you can see them at page 30 of our opening brief, that refer to percentages and say things like at least or no more than, right? So the modifiers were elsewhere in the same statute, but not here. And so under that canon, we think it's particularly powerful that Congress intentionally omitted the modifiers in this section. And again, the House bill had the at least language that was rejected. Second, Congress was not legislating on a blank slate. Congress, it's undisputed, was aware of EPA's pre-existing regulations. Those regulations applied only to 9 to 10% ethanol. And more than that, Congress departed from EPA's regulations in important ways that narrow the scope of EPA's discretion, right? EPA's regulations said at least 10%, I'm sorry, at least 9%, that's not in the statute. EPA's regulations set the upper end of the range with reference to the waiver condition. But again, the statute doesn't do that. The statute says containing 10% ethanol. And indeed, EPA...
That last fact support EPA.
Your Honor, we would disagree with that. You know, the fact that EPA's regulations set an elastic limit, right, and Congress instead put in a specific number, I think Congress's departure from that F4 reference from that elastic limit needs to be given meaning. And speaking of meaning, EPA consistently interpreted paragraph H4 all the way from 1991 until 2019 as applying only to blends with 9 to 10% ethanol. It changed its approach only after President Trump directed the agency to look at new approaches as a way of boosting farmers. Right. Yeah. The third point is the purpose, right? The interveners and EPA make a lot of the statute's purpose, but you have to look at paragraph H as a whole. And when you do so, you can see that the purpose, as much as anything else, is to control emissions. Indeed, EPA acknowledged that in its 2011 misfueling mitigation rule, where it said that the purpose of the statute is, yes, to allow ethanol blending to continue, but also to address and to contain evaporative emissions. And here, EPA has acknowledged, you can find this at page 20 of the appendix, footnote 139, that this rule would result in a meaningful increase in nitrogen oxide emissions. Environmental groups, including the Sierra Club, opposed the rule because it would result in those increased emissions and therefore increased ozone. You don't have to take it from me. You can look at their analysis at pages 288 to 298 of the appendix. So adopting this rule does not advance the statute's purpose. In fact, it undercuts it. And so I think that's just one more contextual reason why EPA's interpretation is unreasonable.
Can you tell me why or how you construe, I guess, the second clause of H4, the deemed to comply clause? Because EPA and the, well, I guess more so one of the interveners says that the reference there to the waiver condition under subsection F4 in part B of that clause supports the EPA's construction.
Right. So a few things on that, Your Honor. EPA notably doesn't join intervener's argument, and you can find EPA's interpretation of that compliance defense at 76 Federal Register 44434 to 44435. We agree with that interpretation. Basically, what EPA says there is that paragraph H needs to be read as a whole. And again, one important part of paragraph H is H5, which allows states to countermand the volatility allowance when it's resulting in increased air pollution. It would make very little sense to give states that option only to have it nullified by this compliance defense that interveners have raised, which is what would happen, right? The compliance defense says that it shall be deemed to be compliance with this subsection if somebody meets all those conditions, and yet that would override the H5 state authority. So that's one reason. The legislative history also, Your Honor, shows that it was simply meant to be an alternative way, an easier way for blenders to demonstrate compliance, not to set a separate volatility limit.
I mean, my reading of the legislative history and the regulatory history is that EPA, prior to 1990, imposed a rule that required blenders to test their blended fuel. And that was seen as by Congress as onerous. And so Congress put this second clause in H4 to say that blenders would no longer have to do their own periodic quality control testing or other testing as long as they could show that the base gasoline had been tested and they get the paperwork to show that, that it met the 9 PSI requirement, and then that the amount of ethanol that was put in, they could certify was no more than the 10% that was in the F4 waiver for E10, and that they hadn't added anything else, then they would be deemed to comply even if they hadn't done their own testing. That's the way I read the second clause of H4. Do you agree with that?
I think we agree with parts of that, Your Honor. We certainly agree that Congress in the 1990 amendment sought to create this compliance defense as a way to make it easier for downstream parties to comply and to sort of get rid of some of the testing and the paperwork. We agree with that part of it. But 2 points, Your Honor, to follow up on that. The first is that the F4 waivers at issue in this case have a 9 PSI limit on them. So I don't think this point helps the interveners in any event, right? They specifically say at E15 at 9 PSI. So I think that that's a threshold reason it doesn't get them home in this particular case. But also more broadly, well, I think I'll just leave it at that. And if I could just, Judge Pillard, to come back to your point about context, the other thing I'd mention here is that our reading doesn't leave EPA without discretion, right? EPA will have discretion to set a reasonable tolerance around 10% to account for practicalities of the blending process. 9% is clearly okay. 11% might be as well. So we're not arguing that EPA has no discretion. What we are arguing is that the rule that it adopts needs to bear some reasonable relationship to the statutory language and its 10% requirement. Had Congress adopted the language of EPA's regulations, we wouldn't be making that argument. We wouldn't have a leg to stand on. But Congress departed from EPA's approach prior to 1990, and that difference has to matter. Your Honors, if there are no further questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
So let me just be sure I understand how that history works in your favor here. By the time EPA is looking at this, the whole notion of the industry has changed, at least with regard to the strictness of looking at the percentage here. And that's what EPA tells us. And to some extent, your clients don't disagree with that. Because they understand that you may never quite hit the 10% mark, but so long as you're aiming at it, seems to be your argument, that's good enough. And since Congress was aware, or this court has to assume Congress is aware of the fact that the language is so different in parts where Congress intended to give the agency some leeway, why wouldn't the requirement be that that in itself is enough, and your argument can stop there, that the agency has to go back to Congress? And even though these arguments can be made, and they were made in this case, where qualifiers were there in the House bill and they were dropped, and EPA knows I'm going to ask them that question, why isn't that approach that the court has taken in the past the one the court should follow? Otherwise, how do we know sort of what's going on here? You say sometimes it could be 9%, sometimes it could be 11%, but your argument seems to be you have to or EPA has to have some way to evaluate the good faith of whoever is subject to the limit. And so if they don't get it precisely, that's fine, so long as they can show that they set up their testing to focus on that percentage. And EPA comes back and says, essentially, look, we're in a different world now. Some things have happened. And you acknowledge that these percentages aren't always going to be strictly adhered to. And given that the legislative history comes out sort of on both sides, you could say, of that argument, and certainly the purpose, says EPA, favors what it's doing, why would the court want to take the position that in this type of measurement, Congress has to be involved at every step?
Well, Your Honor, a lot to unpack there. We certainly
agree understand
with where
a
you
lot
started.
Of it we've discussed, and I just want to be sure I know where you are, having heard some of the challenges to your position.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I'm glad to respond to that. Let me start by saying that you accurately characterized our argument, which is, you know, we read the statute as setting a target. You know, folks who are invoking this volatility allowance need to be aiming at 10%. But you're right. Congress would not have required everything to go through Congress here. There, as I mentioned, there is room for EPA to operate in the statute. As the Supreme Court said in City of Arlington, there's a limit. EPA can go no further than the ambiguity allows. And here the ambiguity relates to the practicalities of the blending process. It's not possible, as EPA has noted, and I don't think anybody's disputed this, to blend fuel right all the way down to 10.00000% ethanol. But that doesn't mean that it's not possible to get very close to that. And EPA has discretion to say how close is close enough, as long as EPA is trying to interpret and apply a 10% requirement, not a floor, not a ceiling, but a requirement. And so that's the way we look at it. And, you know, Your Honor, you mentioned purpose. I'll just come back to purpose. I know EPA says the purpose favors its interpretation, and EPA is free to argue that, but we don't agree. We think it's at least 50-50 here because, again, paragraph H5 acknowledges that the volatility allowance can result in increased emissions and air pollution, and it gives states a way of disabling the volatility allowance as a result of that. Congress would not have adopted those terms if it had thought this is just a maximize ethanol type provision.
But isn't that itself a little bit contrary? I mean, there is a backstop in the NACs, and so that could cut the other way.
There's a backstop under H5, but that backstop wouldn't operate under intervener's interpretation of the compliance defense that Judge Wilkins was mentioning, again, because the compliance defense says it shall satisfy this subsection, i.e. all of paragraph H. So that's one reason. But the other reason is, again, the compliance defense acknowledges that more ethanol can lead to more air pollution. Doesn't say it always will, but it just acknowledges that, and this is, you know, throughout the legislative history, that the volatility allowance was designed to deal with problems that arise when you add ethanol to these fuel blends. So I don't think the backstop cuts at all in favor of the other side. I think it shows again here that this is a specific requirement, and EPA can define the margins of it. It has that authority. But what it can't do is adopt an interpretation that goes all the way up to 99% ethanol. That's just not a reasonable interpretation of containing gasoline and 10% ethanol.
And the premise of your position is that at the time Congress was acting, it didn't realize that the shape of the curve, at least for volatility.
Yeah, the record was not clear on that point. It was not well known. What everybody knew at the time was E10, right? E10 wasn't even in widespread usage, although it was authorized. But people understood E10, and they understood that when you go from E0 to E10, you have a volatility jump, right? About a 1 PSI volatility.
And now EPA, and it sounds like the parties agree that the science shows that there's actually a downward sloping curve somewhere around following E10. And so at least as to volatility and related emissions, they're not increasing. But your point, you say your point has currency A, because we look at what Congress was doing, not what it might have done if it acted today, and B, because there are other kinds of emissions that might nonetheless increase, like particulate matter?
Yes. Yeah. That last point, let me unpack that a little bit, because I recognize that it's complicated. I recommend if you have the time to look at 288 to 298 of the appendix, where Sierra Club and other environmental groups explain step by step how this works. It is true that volatility, reed vapor pressure, decreases slightly when you go from E10 to E15 if you hold everything else constant. We acknowledge that. But that's not the entire story. What happens when you make that change is that nitrogen oxide emissions increase, and those nitrogen oxide emissions combine with other byproducts to form ozone. EPA, again, acknowledged at A20, footnote 139, that would have a meaningful increase in ozone formation.
EPA's position was that it's sort of marginal, that the increases are kind of, you know, testing error type increases.
I think it goes a little further than that, Your Honor. They say small but meaningful, and they say, you know, small but meaningful because the increases survive a multivariate comparison. And again, Sierra Club and others take it even further and say, actually, it's more than small. It's pretty significant. So, you know, there are multiple purposes to this statute, and the interpretation that EPA has adopted here would undercut one of the dominant purposes.
All right, thank you. Why don't we hear from Mrs. Dawson?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm Elizabeth Dawson, presenting on behalf of the industry petitioners with regard to the substantial similarity issue, and on behalf of American fuel and petrochemical manufacturers on the reopener issue. I'd like to reserve 1.5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Beginning with substantial similarity, I would like to discuss three main ways in which EPA violated a statute designed to protect consumers and the vehicles they drive. First, EPA's faulty decision to authorize the sale of E15 at 10 PSI, despite not finding that fuel to be substantially similar to any certification fuel. Second, EPA's arbitrary and capricious technical conclusions regarding the substantial similarity of E10 and E15 at 9 PSI. And third, EPA's improper interpretation of a broadly prohibitive statute with only narrow exceptions. Then I'll discuss how through this rulemaking, EPA reopened its 2010 and 2011 partial waivers and why once reopened, they must fail as well. But first, as to substantial similarity, EPA's rulemaking suffers from a fatal but obvious flaw. EPA promulgated a rule expressly to allow the sale of E15 at 10 PSI. But did not find that E15 at 10 PSI is substantially similar to any certification fuel. In so doing, EPA skirted the very volatility concerns it discussed when concluding that it could not, even in granting the partial waivers under F4, allow the fuel to be sold at 10 PSI because it would cause vehicles to violate emission standards. EPA's conclusion that E15 at 9 PSI is substantially similar to E10 at 9 PSI doesn't answer the question that is actually asked by this rulemaking. Is E15 at 10 PSI, the fuel it wants to authorize the sale of, actually substantially similar to a certification fuel? So although EPA says, and we acknowledge that E15 at 10 PSI might be slightly less volatile than E10 at 10 PSI, nobody is arguing that it is not more polluting, which it indisputably is. So EPA's purposeful avoidance of this fact renders the rule arbitrary and capricious. Second, EPA's cursory rehash of its technical conclusions in the E15 partial waiver decision is also arbitrary and capricious. As EPA has previously recognized, the substantial similarity provision is, as its text implies, focused on the substance of the fuel, while F4 is focused on its emissions effects. E10 and E15 are substantively dissimilar in important ways, both in ethanol content and in volatility. Moreover, though several years have passed since EPA decided to grant the E15 waiver and E15 has been used on the road, EPA decided to rely almost exclusively on those same technical conclusions back in 2010 and 2011 to conclude that it did not expect any harmful emissions effects from this rulemaking, but didn't actually take a look at what was going to happen in the real world. So to the contrary, EPA provided no evidence contradicting the prior findings regarding the emissions effects of E15 at 10, because as I already explained, it only looked at E15 at 9, and it disregarded the concerns raised by commenters in both the partial waiver rulemakings and this rulemaking regarding the effects of E15. Now, third, while this court need not reach the question of statutory interpretation if it concludes and agrees that EPA can't justify its conclusion that E15 is substantially similar to E10 on the merits, ultimately, the statute does not afford EPA the authority to make the substantial similarity finding it did here. Congress enacted the substantial similarity prohibition to ensure that consumers could continue to drive any light-duty vehicle they purchased after 1974 without worrying about whether the fuel used to power it would harm vehicles or the environment. Now, Congress enacted a narrow exception to this in F4, allowing fuels to enter commerce if they demonstrated that they wouldn't cause any vehicles to violate emission standards during their useful lives. But EPA's determination under F1 that E15 is substantially similar only to E10, a certification fuel for a small part of the new fleet, contravenes the plain language of the statute and disregards congressional intent. And EPA's determination that it can even further subdivide the extant light-duty vehicle fleet to find E15 to be substantially similar to E10, as long as it's only used in a certain subset of vehicles, renders superfluous the narrow exception that Congress enacted in subsection F4 and heightens the risk of vehicle misfueling. And finally, at a minimum, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. Why don't you wrap up and then I'll ask
you. Oh. I was just going to say that it's unreasonable also for EPA to interpret the statute to allow it to make a substantial similarity finding for vehicles not certified on the fuel that's being used as the basis of comparison. So here, EPA found or compared E10 and E15 because E10 was a certification fuel, but expanded the finding to cars not certified on E10.
Are you suggesting that F4 does allow a partial waiver for certain years?
No, we don't concede that that F4 does allow a partial waiver, but to the extent that it would, there is no reason then for that partial waiver to be expanded to the substantial similarity provision.
So under your reading, can you identify any fuel that's been introduced since 1990 that would be substantially similar to all certification fuels used in all model years? It just seems like you have to so detach the statute from everything that we know about what it's about and what's been done under it to adopt your plain language argument, which otherwise might be strong.
Well, I certainly understand that that the language that Congress enacted was intended to address a specific problem. And, you know, to answer your question about what has happened since 1990, I can't say that EPA has made a substantially similar determination with regard to multiple certification fuels because it hasn't faced that question in the context of light duty vehicles, because it's only very recently that E10 became a certification fuel. So it wouldn't have had the opportunity to look at both E0 and E10 in a substantially similar determination. But even if the statute might be anachronistic as we view it in light of the changing times, that's not a reason to ignore what Congress provided. As Judge Rogers was saying, EPA would have to go back to Congress if they want the language to change and to expand to allow additional substantially similar findings.
So you're not arguing that every fuel introduced would have to be substantially similar to all certification fuels, including things like diesel or natural gas or the like you're talking about.
So in this context, we are interpreting and suggesting that the court need go no farther than interpreting subsection F1A, which is the provision applicable to the light duty vehicle fleet, because that is what EPA did here. It made a substantially similar finding with regard to light duty vehicles.
But then there's also B.
There is, but the court need not interpret that, which was, as we all know, enacted at a different time.
Mm-hmm. light-duty vehicles like you know, Peugeot or Mercedes that run on diesel, that's not considered certification fuel in your arena? Or?
Well, F1A is applicable to the fuels used for general use in the light-duty vehicle fleet. And so E0 was the certification fuel for general use for light-duty vehicles. And so interpreting that provision, E15 would have to conclude that for a substantial similarity determination to be upheld, it would have to apply to generally to the fuels or, and to the vehicles that are light-duty vehicles.
Right, but there are light-duty vehicles used for general use. I mean, it's a quibble, but that run on diesel, that aren't, you know, industrial trucks, that are just passenger cars.
Well, we would submit that the by general use, Congress meant, as it understood at the time, vehicles certified on E0 and DLEAN.
If assuming, I'm just trying to make sure I understand how your arguments work together. If indeed we agreed with your colleague's argument about H4, do we need to reach this issue of substantially similar?
No, Your Honor. First, as EPA stated, that you know it needs both interpretations to allow E15 at 10 PSI into commerce. Because of H4's limitations, if it does not extend to E15, then this rulemaking cannot stand. So briefly, I would just like to turn to the reopener issue, if you allow me the time.
I just want to be clear, counsel, if I could. If we don't adopt your first argument, do you want to respond to Judge Wilkins' question?
Sorry, thank you
that
for
was
the opportunity.
His question, but I mean, as to there is this subsection B now.
Well, I don't think that it's necessary in this context for the court to reach subsection B. And maybe I'm not understanding your question correctly, but I think the H4 is dispositive. And if the court does not agree with our reading of H4, it can still reach the substantial similarity determination and conclude that EPA improperly either interpreted the statute or applied it with regard to E15 at 10 PSI. If I could have a moment just to mention the reopener issue before concluding. So in this rulemaking, EPA bent over backwards to avoid the perception that it was reopening the 2010 and 2011 partial waivers. But EPA can't insulate those waivers from review by now claiming it can use the F1 provision to take an action that it actually considered to be contrary to law under the F4 provision while keeping its actions under F4 in place. So here EPA sought comment on the waiver conditions in F4 and proposed that they would no longer be necessary, but ultimately concluded that they were. And so EPA claims that it did not reopen those waivers here, but by doing that and by also relying on the same technical conclusions that it did in those partial waivers, it has effectively reopened them. And once reopened, for the reasons then Judge Kavanaugh explained in his dissent in the grocery manufacturer's case, those waivers fail because EPA improperly interpreted the statute. And EPA failed in its technical conclusions, as we included in the comments in this rulemaking. So because EPA violated the statute, both with regard to this rulemaking and the partial waivers, we would request that this court grant our petition for review, and I'd save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Same question, counsel, with respect to your reopener argument. If, for the sake of this question, we were to agree with your argument about H4, would we need to reach this reopener issue?
No, not with regard to the E15 rule. The rule under consideration expressly here is the E15 rule, including the H4 and the substantial similarity interpretation. So the F4 reopener question is separate. H4 alone is enough to doom the E15 rule promulgated in 2019.
Let me just ask you, you refer a bunch of times in supporting that it has to be substantially similar to earlier fuels, that the backward compatibility is a big part of the statute. But what's your best site for that? You make the argument in your brief that the purpose of F1 is backward compatibility. And you alluded to it in your remarks today that somebody should be able to drive up to the pump and not worry if they have a 1980s car. But what's the support for that as Congress's purpose?
Well, I think you can look directly to the statute itself and see that it referenced the model year vehicles 1975 and later to demonstrate that Congress wanted all vehicles that were on the road at that time and in the future to be able to use the fuels that were being allowed into commerce. And to be clear, you know, as we note, and I'm sorry, does somebody have a question? Sorry. So I think we can look to the words of the statute itself to show that that Congress wanted things to be compatible with any vehicles that are on the road.
So they just have to come up with new legislation in order to recognize and build on sort of generational tiers of change technology.
I think that's correct. I mean, it's clear that in both promulgating the F1 and the H4 provisions, Congress was responding to problems at the time. And, you know, it certainly didn't necessarily know what was going to happen in the future with regard to the development of fuels. But there are still cars on the road that were certified on E0. And so it was important to Congress that they still be allowed to use fuels without having to be concerned about misfueling. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Rosen?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. Perry Rosen for the United States for EPA here. First, let me deal with the issue that Mr. King dealt with first, which is the H4 allowance here. We certainly understand that it's not the easiest task to come in here and say the EPA is reversing an interpretation that had several decades, or that a statute with a number is ambiguous. But given the circumstances of this case, that's exactly the case here in this specific situation. As you well know, from a legal standpoint, if Chevron means anything, it means that EPA can go back and take another look at a statute, particularly if it's warranted. And although undoubtedly EPA took this action at the impetus of a presidential directive, executive order, it did look at a reexamination of the statute, and such a reexamination is warranted in this case. We're talking about a fuel blend with just 5% additional ethanol that's been sold for a decade during 2/3 of the year without any significant environmental issues. It served the purpose of an intent of the statute, which was to provide a special allowance for ethanol to support the agricultural industry, energy security, and the other reasons set forth in the statute. And it results in the same, or as you recognize from the briefs, lower volatility, which is the very purpose of Section 7545H, was to give at the same time ethanol a special allowance, but also protect against the volatility. So the question is statute ambiguous? And I think that was discussed in your questions to petitioner's counsel. And it becomes quite clear that it is ambiguous. That
counsel, if we issued an order saying, we want supplemental briefing containing 5 pages of argument, would you deem it appropriate to file a supplemental brief with 10 pages under the rationale that it contains 5 pages of argument and it just contains 5 more pages of argument?
No, no, I would not, because of the context in which that statement is used, Your Honor. But context...
If I told you that an Arnold Palmer is a drink that contains iced tea and 50% lemonade, would you think that if someone gave me a drink that had a teaspoon of iced tea and they filled the remainder of the glass with lemonade, that I would be receiving an old Arnold Palmer?
Probably not in that case. But by the same token, there was a statute that required for piece of jewelry to contain 10% gold to be called gold plated. It contained 20% gold. That statute would be interpreted as at least 10%.
But you've added to be called gold plated. This is a recipe. In my prior life, it wasn't one for very long, but I studied chemical engineering. And when something says it contains a specific percent, especially when you're dealing with chemicals, it means specifically that amount. I don't see any ambiguity here at all. Why am I wrong?
It does in those given situations where the danger is in going over that amount, where it acts as a limitation. But to borrow from an example of the interveners, you know, a restriction or a limitation which says that a fruit juice has to contain 10% real fruit, that has to be interpreted as at least 10%. You wouldn't violate the statute by putting in 15% or 20%.
Well, the regulation that was cited for that example actually had language in it that said that whatever the percentage that you put in has to be the precise percentage, right? That's what the regulation said.
But again, it depends on the regulation. It depends on the context. And I think what we're trying to figure out is what Congress intended here. Otherwise, we are saying you have the potential to put forth a rule that whenever a number is used without a qualifier, it means exactly that and no other number. And in this case, not even petitioners agree with that. If they agree that 10% also means 9%, and it means 9%.
Well, but isn't their response that historically, in this particular environment, indeed in this particular circumstance, everybody understood that 10% meant 10%, particularly where the House bill had the leeway that I think our questions are implying would remove any question in our mind about agency authority. And when Congress says we're taking those qualifiers out, then is the court to say, but the agency can put them back in?
Well, as Your Honor pointed out before, the same is true with the qualifiers on the other side that made it clear that if adopted, it would be no more than 10%. And as we know, what happens in those situations where, in this case, qualifiers are not used, but where it's unclear, that leaves a gap for EPA to fill.
Yes, but I guess my concern is simply that how are courts, much less the agencies, to know what words mean if Congress says 10, but the agency says, don't worry about it, 15's okay. I mean, I just wonder what the principles are that we're laying down. And you heard petitioners reject strongly my effort to get them to discuss this notion that where you have these factors and not all of them point in the same direction, does that leave EPA some leeway to veer away from 10? And the question is asked without any implication that EPA was technically wrong, but simply what did Congress mean? And I understand the point about, well, everybody knew a lot more 10 years later than I'll use 5 years later, so get confused. But words either mean something or they don't. And even if the agency wants to achieve a wonderful result, I guess that's what I'm trying to understand about this case without suggesting one way or another that the court is taking sides or that the court would be taking sides, whichever way it came out. But it seems to me there has to be an analysis that can withstand the test of time unless the court announces, well, we've changed our mind, so we decided to hear this matter in bank, or Congress has changed its mind, and so those decisions are no longer relevant.
We certainly understand that there are absolutely certain situations where you have a number like this in a statute, and no matter how reasonable it is to take a more expansive view of it, you still have to go back to Congress to change.
So Mr. Rosen, what's your strongest, I mean, I see that the congressional commitment at the time to increase the share of motor vehicle fuel that was supplied by ethanol is part of the purpose. There was concern about volatility that we've since learned more about, but there also are these cross-cutting other kinds of pollutants that the petroleum petitioners were referring to and that the environmental commenters were concerned about. There may be decreases in volatility. There may be corresponding decreases in carbon dioxide and non-methane organics, but there are increases in nitrogen oxide and particulate matter. And what's your position on that and how that bears on this question of leeway and also on the petitioner's characterization of EPA's view of the scope and importance of those other pollutants?
And that moves over to the other statutory provision, substantially similar provision. EPA looked at that. It did its analysis. Those determinations don't have to do with its reinterpretation of the statute in H4. So in the substantially similar determination, EPA looked at the very factors that are supposed to be looked at. It did its analysis, and it determined that, first of all, as far as evaporative emissions are concerned, they would be the same or actually reduced because of the lower volatility with E15. As to the tailpipe emissions, some studies showed emissions going up 2 to 4%. Other studies showed those same pollutants not going up at all. And the studies also showed that other pollutants were reduced, like carbon monoxide and other important pollutants. And what most importantly, overall, what EPA found was that none of those small increases would have any material effect on the ability of the emissions equipment to control the emissions. And petitioners make no case otherwise. They don't say that that was an erroneous finding. So sure, when you change, there's always going to be changes in emissions. EPA determined that they were relatively small. And as I say, most recent studies showed they're even smaller or non-existent. There were emissions benefits on the evaporative side. And that was how EPA formulated its conclusion. And that's subject to an arbitrary capricious standard and deference to EPA's technical.
I guess I really was asking about how those other potential effects of different of blends with a higher degree of ethanol might have borne on whether Congress was choosing, you know, we're really talking about 10% as the target versus whether it might have been reasonable for Congress to say, EPA, it's going to be up to you whether it's at least and possibly more. In other words, is the fact that when you add more ethanol, that you're creating these other cross-cutting risks, is that part of the argument that you have to meet or not? I mean,
Not in our view on the H4, simply what the 10% means. I mean, it's the history we've laid out. We believe that the 10% just came out of just sort of where things were at the time. That 10% is what EPA used. 10% is the only commercial ethanol product that was around. 10% is what was authorized under the waiver, the 1979 waiver. And it was just pretty easy for Congress to say, everybody agrees, we're only dealing with 10%. And that's how they got it. But they didn't use the modifier to cap it. And that's why we believe there's some leeway in there. And once Once we have,
if 10% was the only thing that was around and being used, then why isn't that evidence that that's the only thing that Congress was intending to create an ethanol exclusion?
We believe if there was some other evidence of that, then that would be the plausible conclusion. But we see no technical analysis. We see no statements in the legislative history. We see no scientific basis even implied or inferred by Congress as to why that was the magic number, other than simply the fact that 10% is all that had been allowed under F, under subsection F, at the time.
So there was nothing in the legislative history either that there was a potential for E15 or anything containing more than 10% ethanol, nor was there anything in the legislative history or the state of the scientific knowledge that if you went above E10 and kept in adding ethanol above E10, it actually decreased volatility, right? Neither of those things appear in the history.
There was at least one study that spoke to your latter point, but it's unclear whether Congress considered that.
Judge Rogers, I didn't want to cut you off.
I was interrupting you. Sorry. Judge Wilkins, please continue.
So my one more question. I'm sorry. I'll yield. How does the exclusion from the ethanol waiver that's in H5? How is that operative under your construction of H4?
EPA did not consider that in its analysis. EPA's analysis was focused on 10% and what Congress's intent was, the ambiguity of that term and what a reasonable interpretation is. Since EPA did not set forth explanations of the effect of H4 or H5 on its analysis, I'm not comfortable explaining what EPA's analysis might be. I think Intervenors Council has a view on that. You could communicate that.
Well, we have to construe this whole statute in a way that's congruent. So even if EPA didn't say anything about H5, which could in and of itself be arbitrary and capricious, you can, as counsel, tell me whether H5 is now a dead letter or is it?
We don't believe H5 is a dead letter. No.
Why not?
I need to look at the exact wording here. Again, to the extent that the interpretation of H4, that you agree that it applies to 15%, then to be consistent, that would be the application throughout the entire provision. But again, that's not what was EPA's focus here.
All right, thank you. I'm sorry, Judge Rogers.
Oh, that's all right. I'm just trying to understand here. If the court were to opt of the ambiguity in H4, What is the limit to that type of analysis? As I understand it, you're representing a position that it really doesn't matter. These are my words, not the agency's words. What Congress said, in fact, as to a percentage, because the word containing has no limitation, and that gives an agency leeway. And there's good reason here, consistent with the ultimate purpose of the statute, to apply that leeway. That although it's not an argument that E10 was no longer a usable fuel, it seemed to be part of the past. And let's assume, for the purposes of my question, that the scientific community agreed with you.
I'm not certain what the question is.
You want me to just copy what you wrote in your brief, in the opinion?
No, of course not. But
that could be a legitimate answer. I mean, we look to the briefs for assistance, but I just want to be sure that that's where you are after you've heard the arguments of the other two counsel.
Yes, that's where we are. E10, as used in Congress, has an expansive meaning, and whatever limitations are necessary on that come in through other provisions.
Yeah. All right. Any further questions?
So E10, I'm sorry, the containing 10% could also mean containing 85%, right?
Not technically, because it still has to be, it has to be gasoline. The gasoline has to be at least 50% gasoline. But yes, the number is, other than that, unlimited on the top side. And it's through other limitations that EPA still has to permit a fuel to be introduced into commerce. But if it is, and if it checks all those boxes, as far as the 1 PSI waiver, that would apply to higher levels.
Up to 49% under your construction. 49%
yes. Ethanol. Yes, that's correct.
All right, thank you.
Judge Pillard, anything you wanted to ask?
I'm fine, thank you.
Thank you. All right, counsel, thank you. Now, I'm using counsel's names and for titles here because there's different counsel representing the same party.
Yes, so, Your Honor.
Counsel, Mr. Rosen, you want to have some response time now on your 10% argument?
I believe, Your Honor, that
I'm sorry. Are you
this next? This is Ethan Shankman for Biofuel Interveners.
I apologize.
May it please the court.
Please proceed.
I'd like to cover three points if I can. I'd like to discuss H4, a quick note on standing and then turn to subset. First, EPA's interpretation of H4 as setting a minimum threshold of 10% is supported by the ordinary usage of the word contains. I want to go back to the example of a regulation prohibiting a beverage from being labeled fruit juice unless it contains 5% natural juice. Any reasonable beverage maker would understand that language to mean contains at least 5% natural juice as opposed to contains exactly 5%. In other words, a beverage with 10 or 15% natural juice could still be labeled fruit juice. Similarly here, EPA has reasonably interpreted the language in H4 as setting a minimum threshold. It's not a recipe, it's a gatekeeper. As in the juice example, the use of the word contains is setting a standard. It's not describing a set of facts like this brief contains 6,900 words. And the purpose of the scheme is better served if the standard is exceeded. Now, context matters. The whole point.
Can you give me an example of any regulation or statute written in this fashion that has been construed by a court the way that you want us to construe H4?
Yes, Your Honor. The FDA regulation that we cited, 101.30B1, is very clear that when a beverage has the label contains 10% orange juice, that that beverage could have 15% orange juice, but not 5%. It says that the percentage has to be expressed as a whole number, not greater than, but could be less than the actual percentage of the juice. In this case, Your Honor, the whole point of H4 is to ensure the continued viability of ethanol blends, to capture all the benefits of ethanol that Congress had in mind, while keeping volatility within acceptable limits. And here, it is undisputed that the volatility of E15 is actually lower than E10 with the same base gasoline. And Your Honors, that was a fact that was well established before the 1990 amendments. I can give you the precise citation. Joint Appendix 422 cites to a 1985 study that found that the RVP curve for ethanol blends goes down after reaching a peak around 10% ethanol. And EPA started citing those studies as early as 1988. I would be glad to provide citations to the court if that would be helpful. But in any event, these facts were well known before Congress legislated in 1990. Critically, petitioners offer no good reason why Congress would have wanted H4 to impose a hard cap of 10%, which would impede the continued viability of ethanol blends while making things worse, not better, for volatility.
And you don't think there's any reason... Go ahead.
Please. No. Judge Pillard.
You don't think there's any reason based on the other potential increases of the other pollutants that that was not... This is similar to the question I was asking Mr. Rosen, that that was not... wouldn't have been a reason, was not in fact a reason for Congress to say, we're going to stick with the known, we're going to authorize only 10%, because, you know, the graphs sort of go, some get better, some get worse for other reasons above 10%.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The only pollutant, the only pollution problem that was of concern to H was volatility. All other pollutant issues are dealt with in other sections of Section 211, in particular 211F, which is where EPA did that analysis here, and 211C, which allows EPA to regulate other air pollutants. And of course, here, EPA found that there was no material difference between E15 and E10, the gasoline that it would be replacing with respect to any of the pollutants. But that's key. H4 was concerned just with volatility. Now, further support for EPA's interpretation is found in the second clause of H4, which I'd like to turn to, the so-called deemed to comply provision, which is H4B. That provides blenders with a compliance shortcut. To be deemed in compliance, a blender need only show that the ethanol, quote, the ethanol portion of the blend does not exceed its waiver condition under subsection F4. But any ethanol blend can apply for an F4 waiver. It's not pegged to any particular volume. Indeed, E15 itself has an F4 waiver. Congress would not have based the deemed to comply provision on the maximum percentage allowed under an F4 waiver if it intended to freeze ethanol blends forever at 10%. And by the way, Your Honors, I would also like to point out that EPA does agree with this argument. EPA makes this argument in its preamble at Joint Appendix 29 and Joint Appendix 55. It agrees with this interpretation of deemed comply, and it cites it specifically as additional support for its interpretation of H4 as providing a minimum percentage.
You're arguing that the deemed to comply was drafted because there could be some future new blends approved under F4. But the legislative history and the regulatory context prior to 1990 made clear that Congress put the deemed to comply provision in only to obviate the testing requirements for downstream blenders, and that's it.
That is, yes, Your Honor, the purpose of the deemed to comply provision is to provide blenders with an alternative means of compliance. That is true because of the difficulties involved in testing the blend after it was produced. Our point is Congress would not have expressed, would not have framed or constructed that alternative compliance mechanism by reference to whatever is the maximum percentage allowed under F4. If what Congress had in mind was an absolute cap on ethanol at 10%, it would have simply referred to ethanol at 10%.
Are there other conditions other than the percentage in a waiver? So when it talks about not exceeding waiver conditions, why should we read that as not exceeding the percentage of ethanol as opposed to other waiver conditions? Is that even a coherent question?
No, that's a very coherent question, Your Honor. First of all, EPA has specifically addressed that, interpreted this provision as applying only to the volume ethanol percentage, and petitioners do not challenge that aspect of EPA's interpretation. But textually, the phrase in the deemed to comply provision says the ethanol portion of the blend. So it's talking about the portion, it's talking about the percentage. And that's why that's the only thing that matters. Now, it's also important to realize, Your Honors, that EPA's final rule and this deemed to comply provision that we've been discussing, they are both consistent with the original regulatory approach that EPA was taking back in 1988, 1990, at the time that the Clean Air Act amendments were passed. Under those regulations that existed at the time, EPA applied a 1 PSI tolerance to ethanol blends of at least 9% ethanol with no upper limit other than the maximum percentage allowed under an F4 waiver. Yes, at the time, and for 20 years from that point forward, the only F4 waiver was for E10, but clearly EPA contemplated the possibility that there would be subsequent F4 waivers for higher percentages of ethanol blends. And that was carried forward by Congress, that concept in the deemed to comply provision. Your Honors, I would like to be able to say a quick word on standing and a quick word on subsim if the court would allow me to do so.
A quick word.
Okay. For the reasons given in our brief, Your Honor, if this court agrees with EPA's interpretation of H4, then petitioners lack standing to challenge the subsim interpretation and the court doesn't need to reach it. That's because EPA proposed two alternative approaches to addressing Section 211F. Petitioners only challenged the first and not the second. We submitted a declaration from an expert establishing that the same level of E15 sales will be achieved under either approach, and that declaration was unrebutted. So whatever increased E15 sales that petitioners cite as the basis for their injury will occur so long as the court upholds the H4 interpretation. There's no redressability to go on to challenge the subsim interpretation, and that's discussed in our brief. And then with respect to subsim, Your Honors, it was perfectly reasonable for EPA to have conducted the subsim analysis at 9 PSI as opposed to 10 PSI. Subsection F1 does not dictate how EPA is to conduct a subsim analysis, leaving the agency with broad discretion. Here, the relevant certification fuels E10 at 9 PSI and EPA reasonably conducted an apples-to-apples comparison, 9 PSI to 9 PSI. And that was reasonable because Congress separately addressed the volatility issue in Section 211H, which requires an automatic 1 PSI tolerance with no additional air emissions or air emission controls analysis required. EPA's approach in the final rule harmonizes H4 and F1 and gives full effect to both. We would urge the court to affirm EPA's final rule. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, now, counsel for industry petitioner group, Kevin Long.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few points. I'll start where intervener's counsel ended on the standing point. Intervener's expert concedes, and this is at pages 7 to 8 of their appendix, paragraph 15, that a portion of the industry is subject to the F1 substantial similarity determinations and would be affected by it. And therefore, there are several fuel manufacturers who are affected by this, such that it will have an impact in the marketplace. And therefore, API, AFPM, and others have standing here because there is that impact. Indeed, EPA itself said at pages 28 to 29 of the appendix in the carryover paragraph that it presumes and understands that its rule will have this effect. And it's especially ironic. Interveners here are now arguing that this rule that they lobbied for and that EPA dedicated 16 pages of the Federal Register to will have no effect. It's not plausible in light of those statements. So I think that opens and shuts on standing, which, by the way, no one else has challenged. Getting to the merits, you heard EPA's counsel during this argument concede that its interpretation of paragraph H4 has no limit. It goes all the way, it takes containing 10% and takes it all the way up to 49%, and it would go to 99.9%, but for other factors.
Standing on its own, he did say standing on its own that there are other considerations and provisions that would limit it.
Right. As I understand it, standing on its own, it goes to 49.9%, and then the other factors are what limits it there. Otherwise, it'd go to 99%. And that's...
I thought he was saying there were other factors that limit the extent to which it goes from 15 to anywhere higher. That's how I understood him to be describing it. Yes. That the language itself doesn't do the work, but that other considerations do. And that's why, indeed, I mean, they have a challenge from the other side, and they're defending their decision to stop at 15 based on other considerations.
Your Honor, looking at paragraph H, my understanding is EPA has said that it means at least 10%, that there's no limit on that. There may be limits elsewhere in the scheme, but we're talking here about what's a reasonable interpretation of that. And I guess we would agree with Judge Wilkins that this is a formula, a recipe. It says containing gasoline and 10% ethanol, and EPA has just said that it sees that as imposing no limit at all. That's just not a reasonable construction, considering the context here. Right. Congress considered language that would have expressly set a floor. It rejected it. It considered language that would have expressly set a ceiling. It rejected that as well. Instead, it set a specific requirement. So that's the context. And it means, Judge Rogers, to your point, EPA does retain discretion here, but they need to target 10%. That's the limit. They need to be taking a good faith effort to allow folks to aim at 10%. And that might mean 9% or 8.5% or 11%, but it doesn't mean 49%. And in the context here, as some of the judges have acknowledged and recognized, involves scientific and technical changes, things that might have been in Congress's mind when it was acting in 1990. And to that point, I think it's really important to call out Justice Sotomayor's opinion for the Supreme Court just 2 weeks ago in the Facebook case, where Justice Sotomayor explained that technological change and notions of a statute's purpose cannot overcome the clear text. That principle, we think, has equal application here. With respect to the compliance defense, it's notable that interveners' argument would create a gross asymmetry in the statute. If interveners were correct about what that compliance defense meant, then manufacturers would be subject to one limit, and blenders and others would be subject to a different one, right? For manufacturers, it would be infinite, as much ethanol as you want. and for everybody else, it would be the F4 waiver condition. There's no evidence at all that Congress intended the volatility limit to work in that fashion. And again, you know, reading it intervener's way would nullify the H5 option for states to disable the volatility allowance. How so? It would disable it because, again, the second part of H4, the compliance defense, says that meeting those requirements is a defense. It satisfies compliance with this subsection. And so it would operate irrespective of H5. And you don't need to take it from me. Again, EPA said this, 76 Federal Register at 44, 434 to 435. That's EPA's interpretation on it. And I'm just repeating what they said because I think it's persuasive. We agree with it.
Well, EPA also in the preamble, and I think it's footnote 91, they talked about, as Mr. Rosen did today, their interpretation continuing to allow H5 to operate in JA13. So maybe they said conflicting things on this, but I did not take them to agree with you that H5 would be rendered inoperable.
Well, I think actually we're on the same side with EPA on this narrow issue, and you saw that maybe a little bit from the pause from Mr. Rosen. We agree with EPA that H5 is not disabled, and the reason it's not disabled is that intervener's interpretation is not correct, right? There are some areas where we agree with EPA here and some areas where we disagree, but this is one, my understanding is where we agree. And that brings me to where I'd like to close, if you don't mind, Your Honors. Judge Rogers, this goes to your question about taking sides. A ruling that enforces the 10% requirement in the statute would not be taking sides here, because even without this rule, E15 can still be sold. Yes, it can be sold at 9 PSI, which is, by the way, is a lower level of volatility that unquestionably would involve fewer emissions. So in that world, EPA would still have some discretion about what it means for fuel to be containing 10% ethanol, but that discretion would not be limitless. It would be cabined in some way to be tied to real-world practicalities of the blending process. And so, Your Honors, for all those reasons, we urge you to vacate the rule. You need on this suite of issues go no further than the H4 issue. You wouldn't need to get to substantial similarity in all of those other questions, because the rule, as EPA indicated at page 4 of the appendix, is not severable. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. All right, Counsel Dawson.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just have two really quick points on rebuttal. First, to make a factual distinction from what Mr. Rosen explained with regard to the difference between E10 and E15, E15 doesn't have 5% more ethanol than E10. It has 50% more ethanol. And that is an important distinction when looking at what is substantially similar and what is not. Second, EPA has not disavowed the conclusion it reached in the partial waivers in 2011 at 76 FR 4675 when it explained that E15 at 10 PSI will lead to motor vehicles exceeding their evaporative emission standard in use. And that just goes to show how acrobatic EPA's interpretation of the statute had to be in the E15 rule. Because it couldn't get around that conclusion in F4, it had to reinterpret two other statutory provisions to allow E15 at 10 PSI to be sold. And we believe that that is arbitrary and capricious. And for that reason, the court should vacate the E15 rule. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We will take part one under consideration and move to part two. Mr. Berry.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Jonathan Berry, and I'm here on behalf of the Urban Air Initiative petitioners. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like first to break down our first claim, which turns on the meaning of the substantially similar law in F, 211F1. In our view, EPA's key mistake here jumps out at page 2 of its brief when it reads the words fuel or fuel additive as, quote, collectively new fuel. So how does EPA justify reading out this term, the term fuel additive? They do it by reading the word fuel as meaning finished fuel. That is, the mixture that contains not only pure gasoline, but also blended additives like ethanol at a specific concentration. So E10, E15, these are finished fuels. EPA thus says that a fuel manufacturer can't apply to register E20 because it's not sub-SIM to the finished fuel E10. But here's the problem. If fuel means finished fuel, then the sub-SIM law's second verb, increase the concentration and use of, has no effect. Every time a fuel maker says, hey, EPA, I'd like to increase the concentration and use of a fuel additive that's in a surfuel, EPA would say, no, that's introducing into commerce a new finished fuel. On EPA's reading, there's no additional conduct prohibited by that second verb. And so we think there's only one way to rescue the second verb and the term fuel additive from surplusage. You need to give the word fuel its narrower reading, not finished fuel, but neat fuel, like pure gasoline, pure diesel. With that narrower reading, the prohibition's two verbs and the reference to fuel additive all have separate effect. And we believe that if this reading is right, then the presence of the fuel additive ethanol in the E10 surfuel satisfies the sub-SIM law's condition, and ethanol producers like our petitioners can apply for registration where they'll need to satisfy EPA's rules on testing for health and environmental effects emissions and so on. But on our reading, they're no longer shut out of the registration office, and they qualify for the RVP waiver as well.
Mr. Berry. Go ahead, Judge Wilkins.
How do you have standing, I don't know if it's standing or final agency action problem, but how is it that the E15 rule changed the rights and responsibilities of anything containing more than E15?
So, Your Honor, we believe that there are there's a couple of different of avenues there. I think the one that is most straightforward is the question of eligibility for the H4 waiver, for that one PSI waiver. On EPA's interpretation of that provision, which we completely agree with, any entity dealing with a blend that contains at least 10% ethanol is entitled to sell that finished fuel at 10 PSI. But then EPA comes in additionally and caps that according to its sub-SIM determination. So that sub-SIM determination cuts off the ability of folks to sell those mid-level blends like E20.
Mr. Berry, you didn't make that particular harm argument in your opening brief, did you? You made in your reply brief the argument you just articulated, that mid-level fuel manufacturers can't access the 1 PSI volatility waiver that's available under the EPA. Why is that not a reason for us not to consider that in the standing analysis? Why is it not forfeit?
Bear with me for just a moment, Your Honor. So our affidavits, Your Honor, speak to standing. So this is A1 and A2 in our opening brief, for example, on this is at A1, our retailer petitioner that submits an affidavit states, I understand the E15 rule would purport to make it illegal or impractical for Jumpstart stores to sell mid-level blends. This is paragraph 4. For example, the rule limiting the 1 PSI waiver to fuel blends containing no more than 15% ethanol would make it impractical to sell mid-level blends during the summer.
And so the finality argument is that somehow allowing blends with you know, 11 to 15% ethanol carries some kind of negative implication with respect to higher concentrations. I just, you know, I'm trying to, nobody disputes that the rule is final where it applies. But I think, and, you know, and this is really piggybacking on Judge Wilkins' question, how has it affected producers of higher concentration blends who couldn't access the 1 PSI volatility waiver before, who couldn't, you know, who just, who weren't treated the way that E15 is now treated, but still are in really the same position?
Right. So I think the way, to unpack this a little bit is to start with the observation that we don't simply examine state of affairs pre-rule compared to state of affairs post-rule. The important, the source of the disability to sell at that 10 PSI has changed. That was previously traceable to, and I recognize I'm commingling a little bit on finality and standing here, but previously it was treating the H4's number as a ceiling. That was previously the source of the disability. Now it's the sub-SIM determination is the source of the disability.
And why is it a disability, though? That's what I'm not seeing. It's just, you know, agencies operate step by step. And here, there's more familiarity with E15, and they just said, we're going to go step by step. And this is how far we're going. How does that impose a disability?
Your Honor, it's because EPA's legislative rulemaking on H4 caps eligibility at 15%. So if we have a retailer who wishes to sell E20, even though EPA agrees the statute allows that, the rule takes it away. That's a source of an injury.
I'm repeating myself in a sense, but can you point us to anything in the rule that suggest that EPA has reached a final decision that E20 or some other mid-level blend is not substantially similar to, let's say, E15 or E10?
What EPA chose to do, Your Honor, is to limit eligibility on the scope of its particular sub-SIM determination here.
They're letting, you know, the first few people in the door, or the first few blends in the door. Have they said anything more than that's going to be a different rulemaking? And in fact, I know you have a petition for rulemaking and a petition for reconsideration pending?
Yes, it's the same document. Yeah. They're in the alternative.
Yeah. Yeah, and what's the status of that?
So that's pending with the agency, and that's kind of it.
And the mid-level blend producers are able under current law to sell for flex fuel vehicles, right?
Well, Your Honor, that's been put under a cloud by this rulemaking. So, for example, and that's part of the subject of that petition is whether apologize for a little bit of context on this. EPA's regulatory definition of fuel manufacturer excludes oxygenate blenders, fuel retailers like our petitioner who have these blender pumps from the regulatory classification of fuel manufacturer, provided that they mix in ethanol or oxygenates at an otherwise allowable amount. And the implication of this rulemaking appears to be that otherwise allowable is capped at this substance determination.
Isn't there an undisturbed flex fuel rule still on the books? That's 80.1504A3 that allows, that says no person shall be prohibited from manufacturing, et cetera, gasoline containing greater than 10 volume percent ethanol into any flex fuel vehicle. So it seems to say, to the extent there was a flex fuel market separate and apart, that is, I think that's undisturbed. But you're suggesting there's some kind of disability that spills over from this rule that would cabin the permission that that rule grants?
I mean, at the very least, Your Honor, I think that this rulemaking plainly caps the availability of the 1RVP waiver in those contexts.
But that was not available for flex fuel, for sellers of mid-level blends to flex fuel vehicles previously.
So the challenge, Your Honor, is that EPA is now of the view that the that since H4 is to be viewed as a floor, that it should be available, but for that cap of EPA.
But it wasn't available. I'm just trying to, as a matter of positive law, it wasn't available before. It is still not available. You have a much stronger argument that it should be available. And you're saying, you know, great, this new interpretation that it is a floor should help us. EPA, as just to totally, you know, simplify it, EPA has said, well, we're going to do this project now, which has to do with up to E15. But they haven't said, and in so doing, we've told you we're never going to do yours. And so I'm just trying to figure out what has been finally decided with respect to the things that were not on the agenda.
EPA, and this goes to a point from the previous portion of the argument, EPA caps their stated reasoning, caps the availability. It's not that RVP waiver is unlimited in its accessibility. It caps it at both substantial similarity and at applying only to gasoline. Those are the kind of two integrated factors there. But what EPA, and in our view, EPA could have stopped there. But it went on to make this specific subsim determination and import that determination into a hard numeric ceiling that we believe is injurious.
The problem that I have with this is that it's like saying that if an agency said, we're going to, you know, create a new waiver for apples, and then the people who grow oranges say, well, we want you to include us in that waiver as well. And the agency doesn't, and it just says, we're granting this new waiver for apples. Then that's opening the door for the orange producers to sue, to say, well, we're harmed because you didn't extend this new, you know, waiver to us. But we wouldn't do that. We would say, you know, file your petition for rulemaking to get your own waiver. And if that's denied, then we'll review that on the merits. I mean, just because you're adjacent to E15, when the agency says we're going considering what we should do about E15, and you say, well, me too, but the agency makes its decision with respect to E15, that doesn't change your status at all. And it seems like, you know, it's the same as the apples and oranges hypo. What am I missing?
I think the key issue here, Your Honor, is that F1, unlike F4, is not a waiver provision. F1 is self-executing by its terms, whereas F4 requires that affirmative act by EPA to do so. So if EPA, I think this also helps explain why EPA's subsim determination is styled an interpretive rule deliberately and not a legislative rule. But to be a little bit more specific, once EPA undertakes, and we believe they had discretion to not do this, but once they undertake to make a specific subsim determination under the self-executing statutory provision of F1, they have an obligation not to misstate the law when it comes to the text of F1, or misconstrue the law rather. And they also have, they're also required to not, they're required to consider responsible alternatives to the proposal and not give non-arbitrary reason, not give arbitrary reasons for cutting off the inquiry.
Is your petition, did it even challenge the H1? I mean, you point to it in your reply brief as the source of the harm, but your petition is focused on F1, and I'm just, you know, it seemed like that was really pretty clearly all that you were challenging, was the limitation on the F1 construction that the rule embodies, and yet you're kind of sneaking in a different challenge through the back door.
Well, Your Honor, the issue here is that EPA's construction of H4 bakes in what we believe to be this erroneous construction of, like, legally erroneous construction of F1, factually as a matter of kind of black letter admin law, a failure to consider the responsible alternative of U20.
All right.
If I may just very, very briefly, Your Honor, add that we don't believe there's a parade of horribles or a floodgates argument that gets made here. We believe this court has already identified how 211 presents this integrated scheme. 211F is simply one tumbler in a much larger lock. There's lots of other tumblers in registration, not before you even get to 211C's regulatory authority that have to be thrown before these products may flow.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Why don't we hear now from Counsel Dawson? Am I right about that? No, I'm not.
Counsel Rosen.
EPA, for EPA, first, Counsel Rosen.
Thank you, Your Honor. In our view, you focused on the central issue and the obviously initial issue that the UAI petitioners lack standing and lack a final agency action. The challenge rule, this E15 rule, does not prohibit mid-level blends, E16 to E50, we'll call it mid-level blends. It doesn't place any restriction on the use of those blends.
What about the volatility point?
The volatility point is under H1, and these petitioners did not sue under H1. They said exclusively that their challenge is the F1 termination. No one even requested that mid-level blends be considered for the F1 determination here. EPA made it very clear that this rule only has to do with E15. That's what the president directed EPA to look at. That's what EPA said we're going to look at, and that's what EPA did look at. As the court knows, a change in requirements or restrictions placed on a party have to come from a change in the regulation. Petitioners point to no change in the regulatory language that's included at the end of the preamble that has anything to do with mid-level blends.
In considering standing, we assume this petitioner's success on the merits. In finality, I haven't seen that articulated in that way. And so I've just gone back and forth between whether their argument is a finality argument or a merits argument. I mean, how do we decide finality without, in some sense, prejudging the merits of their argument? I don't know if you can help me out with that.
I think it's because of finality, when you look at finality of an agency action, you look typically at the agency has looked at the issue, considered the issue, but not come to a final decision. You don't even get there here because they did nothing. EPA proposed nothing and took no action. They took no final action. They took no preliminary action because they were never asked to. Petitioners in the in their affidavit that they submit from Jumpstart Stores, as counsel mentioned. They allege injury because they cannot sell E16 to E50 for use in light duty vehicles. But that's not the fault of EPA, and it's certainly not the fault of this particular regulation. It's the fault of Jumpstart Stores and UAI, who've not gone ahead and seek a substantially similar determination. Or this statute even has an alternative path for them to seek, which is a waiver. They just can submit a waiver, submit the data that supports their waiver, and wait for the decision. If EPA rejects that request, that can be challenged. But no such request has been made here.
Can you say anything about, does it bear on this at all? Or is it just a fact in the world that they have their petition pending for reconsideration and for rulemaking?
In our view, that's just evidence that they understand the correct path to take, that they can go to EPA and say, we think E20 or E25 is a fuel that EPA should either find is substantially similar to a certification fuel like E10, or alternatively, that it should grant a waiver because it doesn't have significant and kind of significant impacts on emissions controls. And that's what they, in a somewhat convoluted way, but that's what they have done, but they're too impatient to wait for the answer. And that's the proper procedure to follow. This is a little bit, Judge Wilkins, picking up on your example of oranges and apples. The one that I thought of is if the Department of Transportation is looking at expansion of freight and is looking at a rule to expand railroad tracks by 2 feet on each side, that a shipper comes in and says, well, that rule's invalid because you didn't extend the length of tankers by 100 feet, because that would also increase that. It's the same general subject matter, but it has nothing to do with the rule that's before the agency. They can go in and make a special request. EPA would rule on it. They could have a challenge.
So I take it that you would, that there's been no change to the ability of mid-level blenders to sell for flex fuel vehicles. I mean, that's just still the same as it was.
That's exactly the same. They are permitted to do that, yes.
Nothing in the E15 rule changes that.
Nothing in the E15 rule changes that or speaks to that. Mm-hmm. If we get to the substance and UAI's core argument, their core argument is basically once any fuel with an additive is approved, then any other fuel with any concentration of that additive has to be approved. EPA has no choice. Just because the additive has the same name, it has to be approved. Forget the data. Forget the analysis of the impacts, forget the effect on pollution control devices, forget that it actually could increase pollutants to a large degree. Their view is that it has to be approved. And that interpretation would subvert the sole purpose of the statute.
I don't think they've really packaged their argument this way, but to the extent that they are saying, look, you yourself have come up with a statutory construction that does not differentiate between different levels of fuels with different levels of ethanol concentration above 10%. It is therefore arbitrary to draw a line at 15. And as I said, I don't think that's really the way they make the argument, but what is your answer to that? Why is it not arbitrary given your statutory interpretation to stop where you did?
It's not arbitrary because we'd have to consider each fuel on its own basis. If they came in with an application of E20, EPA would look at that based on the same factors that are applied under either F1 or F4, depending on which path was taken. If a waiver application came in, EPA would look at that. So EPA can't prejudge without looking at the technical analysis of compatibility of emissions control equipment and those other factors as to how E20 would come out. We believe, for instance, that E20 continues down that scale of evaporative emissions. It has less volatility. That's one thing in its favor. there are other things that may not be in its favor, and EPA has to look at all those factors. The petitioners, the UAI tries to make an argument and started out with an argument about the wording of the statute. We take a very different view. The wording of the statute under their interpretation would read out a whole portion of the statute. The statute says it's unlawful for any manufacturer, any fuel or fuel additive to first introduce into commerce or to increase the concentration in use of any fuel or fuel additive. That's exactly what they're arguing here. Let's increase the concentration. And the statute says to do that, there has to be a substantially similar determination. And their argument is the opposite.
But then the back, I mean, it's not beautifully written in F1A. The back end of it talks about it's not substantially similar to any fuel or fuel additive utilized in the certification. So there's no comparator for a concentration in use of. It's just like either the fuel is similar or the fuel additive is similar. And I guess your position is, well, this is a fuel and it's not the neat fuel that I think Mr. Berry was referring to. It's fuel, meaning in this case, a blend.
It's the statute requires substantially the new fuel or fuel additive be substantially similar to the fuel or fuel additive utilized in the certification of the model 75 or later. The fuel that was used in the certification here is E10. That's the
And they would say the fuel additive that was utilized in the certification was ethanol.
And that might apply if you were, let's say there was B10, which is benzene 10, a different oxygen. And then you'd say, okay, it's the same level of gasoline, but it's a different additive. Let's compare the additive to the additive. But that's not what was going on here. This was looking at a completely different fuel with different characteristics.
So am I right that you're reading fuel as, I mean, you just said it, you're reading fuel as the package, as a blend, not as referring to neat fuel and then a fuel additive separately?
That's correct. And as EPA explained in the rulemaking, in this case, an additive can be an additive. Let's in that, you know, that B10 example or the other example I gave when it's just that. But in this case, it is a characteristic of the fuel. And under UAI's reasoning, if there's a fuel with 0.5% of ethanol, then automatically any fuel up to 99% ethanol would have to be deemed substantially similar. And I don't know how EPA could ever again approve a fuel blend that has an oxygenate in it under those circumstances, because it would have to do analysis of that blend, not with 1%, but with 50% or 99% of. And this is consistent with EPA's regulations too. 40 CFR 79.21H says that what must be demonstrated is that the fuel additive, when used, the recommended range of concentration is substantially similar to any fuel additive included in a fuel utilized in the certification. So it specifically says you have to look at it at the recommended concentration.
Can you just help me understand how the regulatory scheme applies to E85? So yes. What provision of the Clean Air Act here allows for the sale of E85?
It's the same provisions where EPA has determined that E85 can be used in flex fuel vehicles only that are specially built to take high amounts of ethanol. EPA defines characteristics based, it's you know, somewhat similar to diesel engines or propane gas engines. They're judged on their own characteristics and ability to handle that particular fuel. And even UAI admits in its brief that we're making substantially similar determinations. you have to look at the type of vehicle and compare apples to apples in this case.
But what statutory provision applies to E85? Introduction into commerce.
I'm not sure that there's any special provision for E85. There are regulations, special regulations to it, but it would be under the same provision. Subsection B refers to all vehicles as opposed to subsection 1, which just talks about light duty vehicles. So then within that classification of vehicle and fuel, that's the process that EPA goes through.
You mean F1B?
Yes.
And so same question with respect to mid-level blends.
Yes, the mid-level blends would have to go through, again, either substantially similar determination or a waiver to allow that fuel to be sold. And EPA would apply those statutory parameters to determine whether that's viable or not. And in fact, that's the subject of the pending petition that was referenced earlier as to E16 to E50 and what may or may not be permitted.
But they haven't applied for a waiver or a substantial similarity determination, or you take that petition to be that?
As counsel said, it is in the alternative, and yeah. The second part of it was a petition to allow the mid-level blend.
So that's like an application. That's the same thing. Application for a waiver or petition for a rulemaking on the waiver question.
Yes, and that's the way EPA views it.
Got it.
So are you saying then that for E85, EPA has made a finding since that it is substantially similar to some fuel or fuel additive? And if so, when did they make that finding, and substantially similar to what?
They made a finding that E85 is a certified fuel, is a certification fuel for vehicles, for flex fuel vehicles. And they made a regulatory determination that fuels such as mid-level blend fuels, E16 to E50, are permitted for use in that in those flex fuel vehicles where E85 is the certification fuel.
Anything further?
No, on those bases, and particularly again on the standing and lack of final agency action, but obviously also on the substance, we believe that UAI's claim should be rejected. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Barrett?
I think we have Ms. Dawson first.
Yes, thank you.
Ms. Dawson, Council Dawson.
Thank you, Judge Rogers. Hello again, Elizabeth Dawson, on behalf of American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers, here as an intervener in support of EPA with respect to the issues raised by the Urban Air Initiative group of petitioners. So first, I would just say that in the event this court is inclined to rule for EPA on the standing or final agency action issues, we certainly would not oppose that. I would only add here that Urban Air's interpretation of the statute would amount to a shoot first, ask questions later approach to fuels regulation. Any additive currently present in any certification fuel would automatically be allowed in any concentration, which completely disregards the protective purpose of the statute. The entire reason Congress enacted this statute was because the other portions of the Clean Air Act, such as Section 211C, were not sufficient as a backstop to protect consumers and vehicles with the introduction of new fuels or additives. And, you know, Urban Air in their reply brief seems to argue that there are regulatory measures that would still allow for regulation in advance of a fuels being sold, but those regulations only apply to designated fuels. And how a fuel is designated is by going through the Clean Air Act, by going through F1 or F4. So they haven't explained how those regulations would actually apply to a fuel with a new concentration of ethanol. Additionally, those regulations only apply to manufacturers, and so they have not explained how that would be protective in the case of blenders. Ultimately, while they talk about vehicles such as flex fuel vehicles, their real purpose here, and if you look at their interpretation of the statute, would be to allow ethanol in a higher concentration in regular light duty vehicles, not limited to flex fuel vehicles. Their interpretation couldn't be so limited under their interpretation of F1. And for those reasons, we would agree with EPA that the court should deny Urban Air's petition for review.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So, counsel for Urban Air, Mr. Berry.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple of quick observations. One is that there already is currently an existing designation for gasoline and derivatively of the additives that go into the gasoline. That triggers EPA's extensive regulatory regime under 211A and B that go directly to concentration, even of fuel additives like ethanol that exist in a certification fuel. There's under B1, 211B1, there's tier one emissions characterization. There's tier two health effects testing on typically, I believe, on rats. There's tier three additional residual pre-registration testing protocols that EPA may impose at its discretion prior to granting registration. There's discretion to impose emission control system testing. There is the existing misfueling rule promulgated under 211C that restricts the introduction of higher level blends. And EPA also has maintained that the Clean Air Act's anti-tampering provision applies here. Those are at least five different tumblers in the lock before any alleged floodgates open. I did want to point out there was a sort of an implied premise here that we talked a little bit in my opening presentation that some kind of affirmative, in fact, counsel for EPA stated that some sort of affirmative substantial similarity determination was needed. If that's true, then that seems to resolve any questions about finality, that the EPA has continued to keep the gates shut. As it happens, as I'd said, F1 is in fact self-executing, and that affirmative determination is not needed. Additionally, last thing I would say on finality is that adopting the approach suggested here would have odd consequences for judicial review, because it would seem that someone facing an enforcement defense action of selling mid-level blend would be able to litigate de novo this question of substantial similarity, despite the existence of an EPA rule. Briefly, I wanted to mention the issue of notice and comment, and this to rebut this notion that we're in this.
Just before you go on, let me just go back to what you just asked. If you're right that this doesn't, so assuming your position that ethanol is an additive and that's what we look at, whether it's substantially similar to an additive already approved, I take it though that your position is that we don't look at concentration, but how can that be given that the statute makes the change in concentration a trigger for the analysis?
So, Your Honor, we believe that the only way to give that increase the concentration and use of verbiage meaning in F1 is for it to apply to those non-subsim additives that may be lawfully in use under F4. that's a restriction on the ability of a manufacturer to increase, you know, to take the additive MMT, which is, I believe, currently waived in at 1/32 concentration. If a manufacturer sought to go up to 1/16 or 1/8, that would be prohibited by F1, because MMT is only in use through F4, not through its presence in a cert fuel, because it's not in any cert fuel.
But F4 also has this concentration provision.
That's right. And we believe that F4 is a, F4 does speak directly to regulating concentration in that regard. Once an additive is in a cert fuel by contrast.
Okay.
Then
it can be used in any quantity, whereas when it's in a waived in fuel, it can only be used in the specified concentration specified in the waiver. Is that the decision?
I would put it slightly more narrowly, Your Honor, which is that F1 no longer restricts concentration. 211 A, B, C, and E, I suppose, continue to govern. And the EPA routinely employs those authorities.
So F1, to the extent that it also refers to an increase in the concentration, you're taking that to be a cross-reference to a fuel of a particular concentration that's been given a waiver, and only that?
To an additive in a specified concentration, that's right, Your Honor.
That has been permitted into commerce through a waiver, and only through a waiver.
That's right. This is all part of the same subsim law, 211F. That's the four, number four. And in our view, given the structure of F1 and F as a whole, there's no other way to make increase the concentration use of due work that doesn't create surplusage issues. And I would add as an aside that canon against surplusage, not an iron canon, as it were. And if 211F were the only statutory authority for regulating concentration, that could well be a good reason for ignoring the surplusage concern we raise. But we think in that larger context, there's lots of other regulatory authority here.
Isn't there really no surplusage issue if you just read the part that precedes the comma, or to increase the concentration? It says to first introduce into commerce. So to first introduce into commerce any fuel, and the fuel means the blended fuel, then if you have a new blend, then you can't introduce that into commerce unless it's substantially similar to a blend that's used in certification, right? So there's no surplusage problem there. We don't have to, or to increase the concentration in use of, doesn't have to speak to fuel. It could be speaking to fuel additive.
If Your Honor, if I want to make sure I understand your question properly, but if fuel here means finished fuel, anytime I might seek to, and I'm a manufacturer who seeks to introduce the concentration and use of a fuel additive, that can always be recharacterized as seeking to first introduce into commerce a new finished fuel. There's no reason for that second verb to appear. That's the surplusage issue that we're concerned about. If I could speak just very briefly on the notice and comment issue, the EPA's position appears to be that we're entirely out of scope, that this was a railroad rulemaking, we're shippers or whatever. The difficulty here is EPA expressly invites comments on what other oxygenates may go in here. And this is at JA 64, is the call for comments on this that suggests as of the time of the proposed rulemaking, EPA understood that talking about at least adjacent blends or slightly different concentrations of additives would at least be responsible alternatives that it would be appropriate and perhaps necessary to consider. So we responded in our comment to exactly this prompt, and then EPA turns around in the final rule and says that was all out of scope. And we don't believe that there is a way to reconcile, essentially to give meaning to the duty to consider alternatives. An agency's line drawing decision has to consider what lies on the other side of the line it draws. EPA arbitrarily refused to do just that.
I'm still having trouble with this point. If an agency that's in charge of, schooling says, okay, we're going to consider pre-K. We want comments on pre-K. Should we also have, sub pre-K childcare and or affect kindergarten? And they get comments on that. And in the end, they say, look, this is too big of a package. We're going to go with our proposed rule on pre-K. Does that mean they've made a final rule with respect to kindergarten or early childhood daycare?
So EPA's position appears to be that, as counsel said today, there needs to be an affirmative subsim determination before these products can move past that first tumbler in the lock.
Right. They haven't prejudged that for mid-level. They just have not passed on that. They've given you a great toe in the door because they've said they've interpreted the statutory provision to apply to 10% or more. But what have they said against? That's I think where I'm stuck.
I guess two points, Your Honor. One is that as a matter of law, they've misstated F1 in a way that prejudices us going forward. And then as in sort of an admin law matter, they've arbitrarily refused to consider comments of the kind that they invited. So they asked specifically, explicitly on isobutanol, comments were submitted on isobutanol. They said, that's beyond the scope. Even though in the proposal, they appear to recognize that this is within the scope. The reasoning here underlies the availability of the RVP waiver. So that's a legislative rule that our petitioners and others cannot claim the benefit of. That's a textbook legal consequence or a right or obligation under Bennett Prompt 2.
That's helpful. Thank you.
All right. Anything further?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take that under consideration. And we'll move to part three. Small Retailers Coalition. Mrs. Murray.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Suzanne Murray, and I represent the petitioner of the Small Retailers Coalition. And we are here as directly regulated small entities under the RFS in this rule, and we are asking the court's consideration on a very narrow issue. We'd ask that you review the sufficiency of EPA certification under the Regulatory Flexibility Act before promulgating this rule. Our challenge is based on the fact that the certification required under the act as a prerequisite to promulgating a rule did not analyze the significant economic impact on small service station and convenience stores that sell gasoline directly to consumers. Congress recognized in the RFA that there is a distinct economic impact that small entities may experience as opposed to larger entities or promulgates rules. And so as a result, it directed that agencies must perform either a regulatory flexibility analysis or a adequate certification under Section 605 of the Act, making a statement that the rule will not have a significant impact on a substantial number of small entities. As part of this process, EPA is also directed specifically to run any certification that it chooses to proffer, as it did in this rule, to the Office of Advocacy in the Small Business Administration for review. The Office of Advocacy commented on this particular certification, this rule, and found that the certification did not meet EPA's obligations under the RFA. They said it lacked factual basis and it did not meet the criteria of Section 605. Moreover, we small retailers commented on the adequacy of this rule and acted that and asked specifically that EPA consider the economic impacts of both the market reform, the RIN market reform provisions, and the substantive provisions of requiring the sale or of allowing the sale of E15 throughout the year. In response, EPA ignored both comments and just in the final rule issued a boilerplate section in which it cited to a footnote for a deficient screening analysis that did not consider any impacts on small retailers, only on small refiners, and then only on very narrow parts of the rule proposed. It did not.
Can you please address, counsel, why you have standing given the holding of Grocery Manufacturers Association v. EPA?
Yes, Your Honor. We have standing because members of our coalition are directly regulated under the RFS and under these provisions. We, in our reply brief, also supplied declarations of particular individuals who outlined the reasons that they're impacted and they have standing. We also, as a coalition, have standing to challenge this rule. We're regulated under many of the compliance provisions of the RFS, including labeling provisions, provisions as blenders and distributors.
How do you say directly regulated? It seems indirect, and it's been challenged. Your standing has been challenged as that your injury is speculative.
So
nobody's required to use the E15 blends. So if one didn't have the machinery and didn't want to use it, one wouldn't have to.
Yes, with all due respect, Your Honor, there's sort of two separate questions. We are regulated under this rule, but the aspect of the rule that we're challenging is EPA's failure to look at the regulatory flexibility analysis, which again is a prerequisite to promulgating the rule. What ultimately happens with the rule's implementation isn't our issue. Our issue is that EPA has an obligation to do an analysis of the economic impacts of this rule on gasoline retailers or on small entities. We do represent about, depending on the day, 50 to 70% of the gasoline retail, the small retailers represent about 50 to 70% of the retail outlets for gasoline in this country. And to say that the blends, the concentration of renewable fuels doesn't have an impact, an economic impact on the industry is really not credible. EPA, even in this rule, talks about the challenges of getting these higher blends of E15 into commerce and talks very directly about some of the infrastructure challenges that we've raised in our comments and that EPA responded to. Some of those challenges are not directly tied to the RFS, but to things like underground storage tanks and delivery systems.
But I thought that all cuts in your favor in the sense that they're saying a lot of retailers aren't going to be ready for this, so it's going to come in very, very slowly. And nobody's required to jump up to E15, are they?
So again, Your Honor, it's not necessarily what people are required to do. That what the RFA does is it's sort of analogous to NEPA. It's a hearts and minds statute that makes the agency really step back and look at and explain the economic impacts of its rule on small entities. Here, there could be positive and negative impacts.
We have to identify the impact and whether it's sufficiently direct, because I thought that we had held, for example, in cement kiln, that we've rejected the contention that small businesses who are indirectly affected have a claim under the Regulatory Flexibility Act.
So again, I don't think that you can make the assumption that we're indirectly affected. Any retail station that has to contemplate selling certain blends of fuel, there are real economic decisions associated with that. and also in your mark and your share in the marketplace. There are very real economic decisions about the value of the RIN that impact small retailers and people that are in this industry. There are very real economic decisions about if you wanted to make the choice to participate in a market which allows a sale to be 15 year long, that what sort of infrastructure investments you would make. Again, there are also very real decisions that folks may make because there are incentive programs that may incent people to build out an infrastructure that could support the delivery of higher blends all year long. Again, these are issues that EPA is charged with explaining to small businesses, including small retailers, which most definitely are impacted by the economics of these decisions.
Just to be perhaps provocative on this point, if something happens through a regulation that gives small retailers more choices, they may have difficult business decisions to make, but it's giving them more choices and not requiring that they change anything. In what regard is that harming them?
I think the answer to that is we don't know because you get into the analysis. So all we want is the information.
But that's putting the cart before the horse. We're trying to determine whether whether your clients have standing. And assuming that if there is an impact, that a Regulatory Flexibility Act analysis is required. That's why I started, and I know you say you're not challenging the merits, but I want to understand your theory of how the rule on its merits is regulating your clients. And it wasn't entirely clear to me, and it's remains a little unclear to me what your argument is. It's just regulating them as distinct from changing the landscape in which they operate to give them perhaps some tricky business choices.
So I think the way that the rule is regulating them is that it imposes compliance obligations that impact some of our members. So there will be, and this is also echoed and recognized in the comments that the advocacy office made when it said, the rule will impact non-obligated parties and in fact recommended exempting them from some of the RIN reform market requirements. There is a real recognition that there are the market reality that first of all, many of these gas stations are directly regulated. They have compliance obligations under these rules. Moreover, the way that the reforms are structured will have direct economic implications for them. And not considering those was one of the reasons that the advocate filed comments with the EPA that said one of the flaws and the reason that this analysis is insufficient is it did not consider the economic impacts to small non-obligated entities. EPA must remedy its compliance with the RFA for this rule. So again, Your Honor, I would just respectfully say sometimes there's a little bit of a muddle between someone that's obligated and regulated. We would not argue that we are obligated in the same way that refiners are in this rule, but we certainly are regulated under the RFS. And I don't think that EPA would proffer that gasoline retail stations are not regulated under the RFS, nor do they have compliance requirements when they want to sell E15. All we're asking is that because of that EPA meet its additional obligation under the RFA to provide us the economic analysis so that we can understand the rule and make the choices that Congress intended us to be able to make.
All right, why don't we hear counsel for EPA? Mr. Rosen.
Thank you, Your Honor. A petitioner organization, in order to have standing, must submit affidavits of an imminent injury. They have to describe the injury to actual named members with actual evidence of injury, not hearsay or conjecture or speculation about what third parties are going to do in the future. And it's all got to be caused by something in the challenge rule, by an obligation or a requirement in the challenge rule. Petitioners here submitted none of this, checked none of these boxes. And their reply brief did not cure any of these defects. The reply brief does submit affidavits, but as counsel has stated in their brief, they're only allowed to do that now in their reply brief if they had a reasonable view that standing was self-evident. that view is not reasonable. And that was already decided in the grocery manufacturer's case, where the same type of argument came up and where the court denied standing to challenge the E15 waiver by downstream parties, and specifically found that standing is not self-evident where the regulation issue does not on its face directly impose regulatory restrictions, costs, or other burdens on the party asserting standing. The court went on to talk about retailers in particular and found no direct injury. In any case, the three affidavits submitted by petitioner on the reply brief were form affidavits with blanks filled in, but that's okay. They're allowed to do that. But it all contained pure speculation about what might happen with no evidence, no facts. None refer to a single provision of the E15 rule. None even refer to the E15 rule at all. You cannot possibly satisfy the causal connection element of Lujan standing without even referring to an element of the rule that you're challenging and you claim provides standing. Even their unsupported argument, putting aside the fact that they have no supporting affidavits, fails. If there is no injury from a rule if you're not required to do anything, if you're not punished or fined for having done something. The E15 rule requires small retailers to do nothing. It punishes small retailers for nothing. Again, they fail to cite, even in their brief, putting aside the affidavits, a single regulatory provision in the E15 rule that even allegedly injures their members. They talk about reactions downstream and refer to the renewable fuel standards and other regulations that they allege cause that, but nothing connected to this rule, which is a fundamental requirement of standing. Ultimately, the lack of standing here has already been decided in the grocery manufacturer's case. This court said in that case, which had to do with the E15 waiver, which for these purposes is equivalent to what we're talking about here, the use of E15, quote, neither the RFS nor the partial 15 waivers require downstream entities to have anything to do with E15, and there's no difference here. As to the substance, basically for the same reasons, there is no violation of the Regulatory Flexibility Act. The courts have made it very clear that the parties have to actually be regulated for a regulatory flexibility analysis to be required. And again, these petitioners incur no actual obligations or requirements as a result of the challenge rule. Downstream parties here may have effects, but those are effects from another statute, another regulation, or just pure economics. The E15 rule opened up opportunities for these sets of petitioners. They may choose to follow those opportunities. They may choose not to. There may be effects by what other parties do or don't do, but the Regulatory Flexibility Act, as well as the standing, all require those actions to be set forth in the regulation, and none of them are. And as a result, there's no substantive claim as well as standing under the regulatory flexibility.
All right. Counsel, Mrs. Murray, would you like a minute or two on rebuttal?
Yes, briefly, Your Honor, thank you. So again, the cement case directly says that small entities regulated by a rule have standing under the RFA. We have standing to challenge the rule. In addition, I do find it a little bit perplexing that EPA sort of proffers that we should not have been, that we had no reason to believe that we were regulated by the rule, since in every iteration of RFS rules up until 2018, EPA itself defined gasoline service stations as potentially regulated entities. In 2018, arbitrarily, for no reason that has ever been proffered in the briefs or anywhere else, EPA changed the definition of all regulated parties to potentially affected entities. This change just cannot sort of wave a magic wand over the fact that we are directly regulated under the Act. We do have standing, and all we're asking is for EPA to meet its baseline obligation to do the RFA analysis or to do a certification that is based on facts, not conjecture. Thank you.
Thank you. right. Well, counsel, thank you very much. The court will take the case under advisement.